Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Got my mojo working, but just don't work on you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to our program. In honoring the memory, the legacy, this essentialness of Dr. Martin Luther King, I am going to be having an interview later today with someone who has a lot to say about Dr. King, William Pepper. He is New York attorney best known for representing Martin Luther King's assassin, James Earl Ray, to prove his innocence. King had reached out to Williams in 1967 regarding an essay he had written for Ramparts magazine concerning Vietnamese victims of American napalm missions and was present at Dr. King's famous Riverside Church speech. Williams was the citizens' chairman for Robert Kennedy Jr.'s run for the Senate in Westchester County and also a counsel for Robert Kennedy's assassin, Sirhan Sirhan, arguing for a second shooter. Subsequently, he has been active in many different movements and protests. He holds degrees from Columbia University and a doctorate in education, University of Massachusetts, and a J.D., Doctor of Jurisprudence from Boston College. And he's written several books on Martin Luther King and his forthcoming book, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Very important, and we will discuss that as well. And then I have a two-hour additional special beyond that on the life of Dr. Martin Luther King, and you'll be hearing some of his important talks, including some that you probably are not aware of. I've tried to find those that I believe are unique and original and show different sides of Dr. King and his work. But first, as we do always, we begin with other issues that are important, including a commentary from Chris Hedges from Truthdig, The Mirage of Justice. Also today, something that most people are not aware with, and that is Davos, D-A-V-O-S. It's a group that meets once a year, about 2,500 of them in the Swiss Alps. They are a threat to democracy. Nick Buxton, Common Dreams, tells us why. Also, I watched the debates. I just felt these are just so foolish. And I was particularly galled by the interview with Sean Penn last night on 60 Minutes when Charlie Rose, someone should have to tape his eyelids open. He seems like a hound dog wanting to take a nap. Charlie, I don't know what you thought you were trying to achieve by making maybe him feel uncomfortable that he would interview a killer. But why didn't you ask the more important questions? And I'll tell you what I believe those questions were. But also, why is it that no one's talking about the fact that a vote for Hillary is a vote for war forever? The Daily Beast wants to explain that to you, and we'll share that. So we have a lot to talk about today, a lot to share today. Let's begin. As always, we begin with the latest on health and healing, because I want to empower people to make positive choices. I believe that we all have a responsibility. If we know a truth that can help a human being, share it. Well, think of how many people, especially women, have had problems with breast cancer. And one of the reasons they've had problems is because of the use of the synthetic the hormone therapy. And this is a synthetic hormone replacement therapy. This is not using black cohosh and blue cohosh and squall vine and dong quai, yamiana. Now, those all are good. This is synthetic hormone replacement therapy. Now, this is in the journal Springer Plus from the University of Missouri. And it reveals a very protective effect for a nutrient that occurs in celery and broccoli and thyme and parsley that will help women who are at increased risk of breast cancer due to using synthetic hormone progesterone. And that nutrient is lutein. L-U-T-E-O-L-I-N. And what they found was when administered to cultured breast cancer cells, this nutrient resulted in a reduction in breast cancer cell viability. And the researchers also observed a decrease in the secretion of progestin-dependent vascular endothelial growth factor, or what is called VEGF, which is involved in what is called angiogenesis, which means the formation of new blood vessels. After all, if you can stop blood from getting to a cancer cell will die. So this factor of stopping it is crucial. And curcumin is one of the best things that could help that as well. But this is really terrific. So the takeaway message is simple, and that is, use this nutrient if you have used any synthetic hormone replacement therapy. This is from the study's chief investigator. Quote, most older women normally have benign lesions in breast tissue. These lesions typically don't form tumors until they receive the trigger, in this case, progestin, that's your synthetic hormone, that attracts blood vessels to cells, essentially feeding the lesion, causing them to expand, i.e. cancer. So when they use the lutein, it disrupted this angiogenesis and thereby prevented the growth development of progestin-driven tumors. Quote, it is therefore essential that further investigate the mechanisms by which lutein moderates progestin effects in order to fully exploit its therapeutic model. Well, you don't need any more research to know that a non-toxic, completely natural nutrient is there already. Now, remember when I said that you're diluting juice should be green apple, celery, or cucumber. So if you're using celery, you're already getting a lot of it, and that is important. Heart disease is the number one cause of physical death as far as an organ system, and we want to do all we can to prevent any form of heart disease. This is from Cape Peninsula University of Technology in South Africa. Drinking rooibos, that's a tea, can lower your chance of having a heart attack, and it is extremely important. This is a tea that you find in health food stores. Rue, R-O-O-Ibos, I-B-O-S. And drink that or take the capsules. I would rather take the capsules because that's an awful lot of tea to drink in a day. So this way you can take it easily. And what is important is they found in the scientific research that it helps protect your heart. Why? Because of polyphenols, antioxidant, and a particular nutrient, and I'll spell it, aspalathin, P-A-L-A-T-H-I-N, aspalathin. Now, these substances protect our bodies from the cell-damaging effects of free radicals or oxidative stress, air pollution, alcohol, fried foods, sugar, coffee, therefore guarding us against a host of serious non-communicable diseases. Oxidative stress is an any imbalance between the production of free radicals and the ability of the body to counteract or detoxify their harmful effects through neutralization by antioxidants, such as vitamin C, such as vitamin E. That's why I always suggest when you're in any environment where you're creating free radicals, always take some vitamin C. It traps them, and that helps you. So this was a good study, and so get that into your system, and one more way to protect you from a heart attack. University of South Carolina School of Medicine. This is a way to help fight depression. How so? Resveratrol. Glass of red wine, they're suggesting. And this was presented at the American Society for Pharmacology and Experimental Therapeutics at their annual meeting in experimental biology. Quote, We found that administering resveratrol blocks the inflammation we would normally see in animals undergoing the bullying stress and brings into control levels. And then it goes on to talk about then that in a turn, in other words, when we're being put upon by people in our lives or in the workforce who do not respect us, do not show us the respect we deserve, and as a result, we feel in some way intimidated, overwhelmed, we felt disrespected, and hence we go into a depression. So what they're suggesting here is that just having that one glass of red wine and its chemical called resveratrol can make an enormous difference. However, here's my problem with it. First of all, unless you're drinking organic wine, you're getting sulfates. And that can create a lot of oxidative stress that is not healthy. So I suggest that you use resveratrol from grape juice, which has, at least 10 times more resveratrol in it. But almost all the research in the world is on wine instead of grape juice. And it's amazing because all wine comes from grapes. So, you could actually have other wines. You get peach wine and pear wine and what we call a apple wine, which is apple cider vinegar. But you don't know how those grapes are sprayed, and grapes could be one of the most sprayed items there is, unless it's organic. And also you have alcohol. So by the time you get the amount of resveratrol that they say is beneficial, you already could have been destroying some brain, liver, and kidney and heart cells with alcohol. Now, if you have an occasional glass of red wine, and if it's organic, and if it's low alcohol content, that's fine. That's not a problem. In fact, when I was traveling on my last trip to France, I had someone who said, I'll show you how we do it, because I want to know how do they make their own wine, because everybody makes their own wine. It's not that difficult. And he took me to a modest house in the country, and from the outside, it looked like, I'm guessing, a 2,000 square foot house, had fields around it, nice landscaping, but nothing fancy. This was just a regular middle-class working person. What I didn't expect is when we went down this ramp into this guy's basement, he had 12,000 bottles of wine. Some were decades old, and this was his hobby, making wine. So he was like the master local winemaker. So I said, do you make this natural? He makes all of his wine naturally. And he explained how he does it, what kind of grapes he gets, and the organic grapes, and he doesn't want anything sprayed. They're very smart about this stuff. If you think somehow that people working with food, growing food, are ignorant of the consequences of pesticides or GMOs, think again. There's a lot of very educated people in that field. In any case, he had all this low alcohol wine, and low enough that it would not have been a problem. But and he had every kind of wine from very dry to very sweet, and he would give them as gifts. And I don't drink, but my friends who went with me did, and so they took a case of this. He gave them a case of different types. And it was just, he said, everybody drinks the organic wine around where he's at. Everybody. But they also have a whole bowl of grapes generally on a table. He said, grapes, it's just what you eat in the way of candy in America. We eat is grapes, and we finish our meal with grapes. Now, the Italians do that more often than the French, who are into desserts big time, and no one's into desserts like the Germans. Huge portions. But the resveratrol content of a bottle of wine is small. I mean, it's not a lot. So could you imagine if you had a glass of grape juice where you're getting 10 times that amount, but why not have 150 or 200 milligram capsule? And that way you're getting a lot more, 5 milligrams out of a glass of wine, maybe 50 out of a glass of grape juice, 200 out of a capsule, and its high-end therapeutic value is around 150 milligrams. So in this case, what it does, quote, resveratrol appears to knock down inflammation throughout the body. That's good. And so therefore, when you don't have the inflammation, you reduce depressive symptoms. Because they're suggesting here that depression and pro-inflammation in the brain go hand in hand. Well, indeed, there's a lot of science showing that if your brain is inflamed, you're more susceptible to depression because your body doesn't know how to react to that inflammation and frequently feels under siege. And finally, our body ages at different levels. And that's why sometimes a person seems to be okay, and yet the heart goes, or the lungs go, or the liver goes. And you ask, why? Well, because just imagine that each organ of the body has a different biological clock. Therefore, for example, if you're really living healthy and you're detoxifying and you're rejuvenating simultaneously, then your body is going to have less damage, less DNA defection. You're going to have a longer life for that. For example, if you take coenzyme Q10 every day, 200 to 500 milligrams, if you take magnesium each day, if you take hawthorn, if you take vitamin E, L-carnitine, your heart is not going to be the same age as your chronological age. So you could be 50, but your heart could be 30. But let's say that you smoke and you drank and you were stressed and you had fatty food. You're 50, your heart could easily be 90. And hence, your heart muscle becomes flabby and weak. That's myocardiomyopathy. You could end up having, through stressors, a regular heartbeat. And therefore, you got to be aware that each one of those organs has a different date on it. Now, what is the organ that we generally see damage coming late? And by the time we see the damage, it's almost always too late. It's the brain. I had a chance just last week. I've been filming. I'm out filming every day. Spain twice, London twice within a week, up in Worcester, Massachusetts, Phoenix, Arizona. This is all just in the last 7 days. And I'm working on some very important socially relevant projects. I'll be finished in the near future on these. And in one of these environments, one of the people who I was filming said, I hear that you're able to work with people who have brain condition. I said, yes, I help people. And the person said, well, my father seemed to be perfect until about 6 months ago. And now there's something wrong. He will forget dates, names, places. He'll forget that he said something. He'll repeat himself 5 or 10 times in a conversation, but he's unaware of it. And this is something brand new. And I said, the symptoms are manifesting brand new, but that probably took his whole life to create. And I asked, go through a given day and tell me what your father's exposed to. And the person went through all the things that the father's exposed to, and it's the typical American diet. And younger smoked and drank. So even though the father's not old chronologically, only 65, biologically his age is probably 95. So he's exactly where he's supposed to be based upon what he's done that's constructive to slowing brain aging and what he's done destructive that will do it slowly but surely. You got over 100 billion cells, so killing 1 million cells each day is easy to do without knowing it until that day comes when the symptoms manifest. By the time you see the symptoms manifesting, you're long into a disease. So there's a new article in Cell Systems on aging. And here's what it says from Life Extension. Quote, aging may be one thing in our to your liver and another to your brain. Researchers at the European Molecular Biology Laboratory, the Salk Institute, and the University of California compared brain and liver cells of 6-month-old rats to those of 24-month-old animals. They found that aging equally affected immune and stress responses as well as inflammation. However, metabolic processes were mainly impacted in the liver. There's your sugar, by the way. There's your refined carbohydrate. There's your bagel. There's your donuts. There's your pastas. There's your bread. There's your pretzels. There's your candy. And in the brain, same thing. And aging mainly affected signaling processes. Well, it affects a lot more than that, but that's what they were looking for. And keep in mind, the liver is very rejuvenative. You can have half your liver gone and still rejuvenate it. But the older you get, the more difficult that becomes. So they found this idea that you age differently, each system, and that they manifest differently. Quote, we found that in brain age-related changes very often have to do with the loss of molecules that help signals to spread among neurons. This could explain why older rats have a reduced ability to form new connections between neurons, as well as other traits observed in the aging brain. So in lay language, what this means is this. You are never one age. You're never your chronological age. You're only your biological age. And that's that biological age that determines the quality of your life and how long you'll live. Now the good news is, and it's very good news, that we now know how with a living foods program, a plant-based, healthy, organic, highly energized food selection, that we can reverse a lot of damage, repair DNA, increase neurons, and increase the mitochondria. We have this today. It's not the future. It's not speculative. It's now. But you can't keep doing what you're doing and just throw in something new. Oh, yeah, my brain's going, so I'll take some PPQ. Or glycerophosphorylcholine. It doesn't work that way because there's something more fundamental underneath of it. It's not just how you directly impact a cell. It's also your intent. And it's the intent level that is foundational. And it's the intent level that determines whether the DNA epigenetically is turned on for healing or off for diseasing. On for love, off for rage. On for giving, off for selfishness. On for empathy, off for indifference. On for humility and heartfelt apology. Off for stridency, contentiousness, obstreperousness, and indifference to whether someone believes you're wrong. If you don't believe you're wrong, you get in their face and you argue. But the real self knows the truth. The epigenetic self can't tell the truth. And that's why for years now, I have worked on the foundational epigenetics of helping people at that level to change. And that's where the real changes occur. Just changing a person's diet in and of itself, it only has a relatively small impact. Change the attitude the person has, and then change the diet, and you can see some remarkable improvements. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a brief break, come back. I've got some very interesting commentaries that I've written, others have written, to share with you. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to be going to my guest in about 10 minutes. I wanted to set aside part of today's program in honoring the legacy of Dr. King by having someone who has a lot of unique insights to share with us, and that would be William Pepper. He is well known for his work in human rights, in seeking the truth. He's a very brilliant man. And he has some first-person insights. We'll talk to him shortly. But I'm also concerned about what King stood for. What did he stand for? Ask a lot of young people today. They know the name Martin Luther King. They'll know his picture. Now say, what exactly was he for? Then it becomes very vague for most people, especially younger people, certainly not the people who were contemporaries or those who were motivated by him. What he was for was justice. He was for all forms of justice. Think of today. Well, I spent 7 years trying to find the pieces to put together to show the average person, the professional person, the successful financial or career person, the super wealthy person, the super poor person, all different strata of society, what it meant to be suffering in the United States in ways that are frequently invisible. Because the real number of unemployed is over 106 million. The real number of hungry children is closer to 20 million. The real number of homeless kids that leave school each day and don't go home, they go to a shelter, or they go to live in a car, is 1.6 million. The real number of people who are seeking food assistance at ever-dwindling food supplies at food banks that they frequently have to get there at 6 in the morning are over 55 million. The real number of those individuals who are considered extremely poor, meaning living on less than $2 a day, is over 3 million. Put another way, you could fill one-third of all the homes in New York City with just people living on $2 a day or less. And yet you don't see them. What's the real number of people who've lost their homes and were made homeless and had to go live with friends in their basements and attics garages done up, throw down a rug, put in a portable toilet? About 32 million. So those numbers you hear about who are on the street, that's only what you see. It's what you don't know about being poor, unless you are very poor. If you're poor, you almost never go to trial. According to Chris Hedges, and he should know, he is probably right now the most critical writer. They're good writers, but he is one of the most skilled at articulating what happens if you're poor. Why? Because instead you'll be forced to accept a plea deal offered by government prosecutors. If you're poor, the word of the police, who are not adverse to fabricating or tampering with evidence, manipulating witnesses, and planting guns or drugs, will be accepted in a courtroom as if it were the Word of God. If you are poor, and especially if you are poor and of color, almost anyone who can verify your innocence will have a police record of some kind and therefore will be invalidated as a witness. If you are poor, you'll be railroaded in assembly line production from a town or city where there are no jobs through the police stations, county jails, courts, directly into prison. And if you're poor because you don't have money for adequate legal defense, you will serve sentences that are decades longer than those for equivalent crimes anywhere else in the industrialized world. I thought one of the statements by Bernie Sanders in his final debate before the primaries that was legitimate, and I would certainly support, was that you have people where Hillary Clinton lectured on Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, where she received over $600,000 in lecture fees. By the way, add in how much her husband received, which were almost double that amount, and yet not a single person from any of the big banks went to jail or held accountable, even though they were found involved in multiple crimes and had to pay billions of dollars. But that's the game. They have billions of dollars in money that they earned off debt-related investments and bad judgments in illegal activity, like manipulating the price of currencies, like gold and silver. And they knew that because of the control they have in Washington, they would not pay the price of loss of their charter and going out of business. They would simply have a cost of doing business, pay a $1, $2, $3, $5 billion fine, and everybody's happy. They all did the crime. None of them will do the time. At least Sanders stated that, and he would not tolerate that, nor a Justice Department that would allow it. But that's all we've had, our Justice Departments, executive personnel, and legislators who not only allow it, but almost demand it. If you're poor, because you don't have money for adequate legal defense, you will serve sentences that are not equivalent to the crimes anywhere else in the industrialized world. If you're a poor person of color in America, you understand this with a visceral fear. You have no chance. Being poor has become a crime, and this makes mass incarceration the most pressing civil rights issue of our era. There's a 10-part documentary online. I don't know if you've seen it. I recommend it. It's called Making a Murderer. It's written and directed by Maura Demos and Laura Riccardi, and it chronicles the endemic corruption of the judicial system. The film focuses on the case of Steve Avery and his nephew, Brendan Dassey, who were given life sentences for murder without any tangible evidence linking them to the crime. As admirable as the documentary was, however, it focused on a case where the main defendant, Avery, had competent defense. He was also white. The blatant corruption and probable conspiracy by the county sheriff's office in this case, and then the county district attorney, is nothing compared to what goes on in the well-oiled, deeply cynical system in place in inner city courts. The accused in poor urban centers are lined up daily like sheep in a chute and shipped to prison with a startling proficiency. The attempts by those who put Avery and Dassey behind bars to vilify them further after the release of the film misses the point. Two men, like most of the rest of the poor behind bars in the United States, did not receive a fair trial. Whether they did or did not murder the person the film makes a strong case that they did not, is a moot point. Once you're charged in America, whether you did the crime or not, you're almost always found guilty. Because of this, as many activists have discovered, the courts already are being used as a fundamental weapon of repression. And this abuse will explode in size should there be widespread unrest and dissent. Our civil liberties, which have been transformed into privileges, who was it, Matt DeBibi, and wrote The Divine American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap, calls conditional rights and conditional citizenship that are especially in poor communities routinely revoked. Once rights become privileges, no one is safe. In any totalitarian society, including an American society ruled by its own species of inverted totalitarianism, the state invests tremendous amounts of energy into making the judicial system appear as if it functions impartially. And the harsher the totalitarian system becomes, the more effort it puts into disclaiming its identity. The Nazis, as did the Soviet Union under Stalin, broke the accused down in grueling and psychologically crippling interrogations, much the same way that the hapless and confused are manipulated and lied to by interrogators to make them sign false confessions. And totalitarian states need the facade of justice to keep the public passive. It was in the Guardian newspaper that they wrote a story, The Innocent Project, has kept detailed records of the 337 cases across the United States where prisoners have been exonerated as a result of DNA tests since 1989. And the group's researchers found that false confessions were made in 20% of all DNA-related exonerations. Now, that's a striking proportion of, in and of itself. But when you look only at homicide convictions, by definition the most serious cases, false confessions are the leading cause of miscarriage of justice. Fully 63% of the 113 exonerations were for people who falsely wrote that they killed someone, but they did not. They were innocent. The interrogator butcher isn't interested in logic. Wasn't that Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote in the Gulag Archipelago? He just wants to catch two or three phrases. He knows what he wants. And as for us, we are totally unprepared for anything. From childhood on, we are educated and trained for our own profession, for our own civil duties, for military service, to take care of our bodily needs, to behave well, even to appreciate beauty. But neither our education nor our upbringing nor our experience prepares us in the slightest for the greatest trial of our lives, being arrested for nothing and interrogated about nothing. If the illusion of justice is shattered, the credibility and viability of the state are jeopardized. The spectacle of court, its stately courthouses, its manners, its rituals, its legal rituals and language, is just part of the theater. The press, as we've seen, serves as an echo machine for the state, condemning the accused before they are even on trial. Television shows and movies about crime investigators and the hunt for killers and terrorists feed the infectious narrative. The reality is that almost no one who is in prison in America has gotten a trial. There's rarely an impartial investigation. A staggering 97% of all federal cases and 95% of all state felony cases are resolved through plea bargaining. Of the 2.2 million people who have incarcerated at the moment, right now, 25% of the world's prison population, 2 million, never had a trial, and a significant percentage of them are innocent. Judge Jeb Rakoff, in an article in the New York Review of Books entitled Why Innocent People Plead Guilty, explains how this secret of plea system works to thwart justice. Close to 40% of those eventually exonerated of their crimes originally pled guilty, usually in an effort to reduce charges that would have resulted in a much longer prison sentence if the case had gone to trial. The students who study this are fully aware that if you're given the idea, if you plead guilty now, you know, I can get you 2 years. If we go to trial on this, you're going to get 40 years. Well, look at the outcome. The wrongly accused and their families, as long as the fiction of justice is maintained, vainly seek redress. They file appeal after appeal. Those convicted devote hundreds of hours of study in the law library in prison. They believe there was a mistake made. They think that they are, if they're patient, the mistake will be rectified. Playing upon such gullibility, authorities allowed prisoners in Stalin's gulags to write petitions twice a month to officials to proclaim their innocence or decry mistreatment. Those who did not understand the American system, who are not mentally prepared for its cruelty and violence, are largely helpless before authorities intoxicated with the godlike power to destroy lives. And these authorities advance themselves or their agendas. Joe Biden, when he was in the Senate, and Bill Clinton, when he was president, did this by being supposedly tough concerning law and order and national security. What hypocrisy in Clinton's case. Those who administer the legal system wield power largely in secret. They are accountable to no one. Every once in a while, this happens even under the Nazis and Stalin's regime, someone will be exonerated to maintain the fiction that the state is capable of rectifying its mistakes. But the longer the system remains in place, the longer the legal process is shrouded from public view, the more the crime by the state accelerates. The power elite, or corporate rulers, and the security and surveillance apparatus rewrite laws to make their criminal behavior legal. It is a two-tiered system. One set of laws for us, another set for them. Wall Street's fraud and looting of the U.S. Treasury, the obliteration of our privacy, the ability of the government to assassinate U.S. citizens, revoking the habeas corpus laws, the neutralization of our Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable search and seizures, the murder of unarmed people in the streets of our cities by militarized police, the use of torture, the criminalization of dissent, the collapse of our court system, the waging of preemptive war by rendering legal politicians, legislators, lawyers, and law enforcement officials who understand that leniency and justice are damaging to their careers, and whom it was said, quote, they are leeches on the capitalist structure, have constructed for their corporate masters our system of inverted totalitarianism. They serve this system. They seek to advance within it. They do not blink at the victims destroyed by it, and most of them know it is a sham. It was Solzhenitsyn who said, we have to condemn publicly the very idea that some people have the right to repress others. In keeping silent about evil and burying it so deep within us that no sign of it appears on the surface, we are implanting it, and it will rise up a thousandfold in the future. When we neither punish nor reproach evildoers, we are not simply protecting their trivial old age. We are thereby ripping the foundations of justice from beneath new generations. Back in a moment with my guests. Please stay with us.
Live from New York, it's the...
Let's go now to my guest, William Pepper, New York attorney. Nice to have you with us today.
Yes, Gary, it's good to be with you.
I'd like to begin with your own personal experience of personally knowing Dr. King in the 1960s, especially during the last year or so before his assassination. This included the time when he gave his famous Riverside Church speech, which you attended. And one of the key observations you and other King historians have noted is that Dr. King's own thought was evolving and expanding, and this was in line with the increase in his sphere of influence. And it wasn't simply civil rights for African Americans, but more about civil rights for all and the need for dramatic systemic change in U.S. government and Washington policies if there was any chance of preserving America as a democracy. So please share your own personal experiences and meetings with Dr. King, and then speak about the course of his evolution that you personally observed.
Yes, well, as you've said, Gary, I only knew Martin King the last year of his life, and that occurred because I was a young independent journalist in Vietnam, and was out in the country a good deal of the time and took a wide range of photographs, and those photographs and an article were published by Ramparts magazine. Martin King was a subscriber to Ramparts, and he came across them at the Atlanta airport when he was on his way to the Caribbean, Bernard Lee recalls, and he pushed away his food and said, I can never enjoy a meal again so long as this war continues. So the brutalization of the Vietnamese people was so rampant and so devastating that it moved him. He then asked to meet with me, and we then did become close just that last year of his life. And one move from Providence, Rhode Island, where he had spoken at Brown, up to Harvard, where we were together opening Vietnam Summer, I opened the files to him that I had, and he literally wept in the car, in the backseat of the car on the way up. He was so tortured by what this country was doing. He went on, of course, to oppose the war throughout that last year of his life. I remember a meeting in John Bennett Chamber of Study at the Union Theological Seminary that Ben Spock, myself, Andy, and Martin had, and Ben was pushing very hard for draft resistance, and Martin was very sympathetic to that, and because it was a major nonviolent protest against the war, and he was adapting the nonviolence of the civil rights movement now to international human rights, and he was becoming, as you have said quite rightly, he was becoming so terribly involved and immersed in the militarism and the imperialism that America was visiting around the world, but particularly in with respect to Vietnam. He asked me to head a coalition movement which came known as the National Conference for New Politics, and we brought together 5,000 people at a convention on Labor Day 67 following his UN speech on April at Riverside Church on April 4, and the UN speech on April 15th, I introduced him at that speech and called for a third-party political ticket between of him and Ben Spock. And he had committed to that for the purpose of dramatizing the effect of the war. The NCNP convention had over 5,000 delegates who came from all over the country and all stripes of political liberal political anti-war peace and freedom individuals, and Martin introduced him, and he's a keynote speaker, and as he was speaking a note was passed over my shoulder and it said, get him out of here or we will take him hostage and embarrass him before the world. Now that came from a black caucus. That was a government operation using Blackstone Ranger gang members and others who dragooned black members who came to the convention into a group for the purpose of really breaking up the convention and destroying it. And of course, Martin was a unifier, and that couldn't be allowed to happen. But I think the critical reasons why they killed him had to do more with his mobilization of poor people for a march on Washington that was going to take place in spring of 1968, and he was going to bring over at that point over 500,000 people, and the military was, as we have learned, were very uneasy about this because there was such dissent and such turbulence in the country. There had almost been a revolution in France, as you know, during that period of time. The world was on fire. They were never going to allow him to bring that mass of people to Washington. They were afraid it would turn into a revolutionary group, and they didn't have the troops to put it down. Westmoreland wanted 200,000 more for Vietnam. They didn't have those. They didn't have the troops at home. So they had to get rid of him. And when they assassinated him, I naively, like many, believed that eventually when they picked up James Earl Ray that they had the right guy. And I just effectively, Spock and I went down to the memorial, and then we went into Atlanta, And Bobby Kennedy asked us to come up to his suite and asked me if I would come, because I had helped Bobby in 64 when he ran for the Senate in New York. And I said, no, I'm through. I'm not going to have anything more to do with politics. And then I went in another direction. 9 years later, Abernathy called me, and we had kept in touch over the years, and he said, look, will you go and interview Ray in prison with me there? I said, Ralph, but you went round the bend, because he wanted to resurrect some questions for Ray, and I didn't know anything about the case at that point, and it took me several months to get up to speed. I did conduct a five-hour interrogation of James Earl Ray, with several people in the room, including his lawyer at the time, Mark Lane. And we came out of that very heavy interrogation and interview meeting with a clear view that James was not the shooter. Didn't know what role he might have played, but he was clearly not the shooter. We don't need to go into those details. I would go visit him several times in the institutions where he was held. He was coerced into exactly what you're talking about, Gary. He was coerced into a plea by his lawyer, Percy Foreman, who gave his brother $500, and we have this in writing, and on the commitment that that $500 could be used for James to appeal his guilty, his plea bargain, effectively, if you will. So the system was manipulated. He never had an adversarial trial, and he was put away. I would visit him continually. He raised so many questions that I started going into Memphis on a regular basis, quietly underground, and trying to answer all the questions that he raised and he put in our minds. So I was doing this for quite a period of time. At one point, it became known that I was up to something, and we started getting some threats. It was only when one phone call came through, and my 4-year-old son at the time picked it up, and he was told that his father was not going to be living much longer if he didn't stop putting his nose into the King assassination. That was. All I needed to make the decision to move to England. So I moved the family to Cambridge, where I was a visiting fellow, and we lived there for 20 years, but I commuted back and forth continually in order to conduct this investigation. I took James's case up to the Supreme Court. We were denied cert, and it looked like the end of the road. We finally had a television trial that was put on by Thames Television and HBO in 1993. It took a jury around 7 hours, having heard all the evidence that we had at the time, to find James not guilty. And this was a shock to the system, but it also opened up the doors of more and more evidence started coming in. The first book I did on the case was in 1995. It was not reviewed anywhere. Gary, you more than anyone that I know has brought attention to the effect of this kind of writing and controversy on mainstream media. The control of corporate media over this kind of information is staggering. We had a small window at one point back in the 60s. Bill Atwood was editor. You probably recall Bill Atwood was editor of Look magazine, and Bill wanted to do an article on my Rampart's piece. And I went in to see him at his request at Look, to give you an idea of what was emerging at the time. And he told me he had a visit the previous week from Averill Harriman, the doyen of the Democratic Party, who carried a message from the President of the United States. And the message was, first of all, best wishes and high regards and all of that, and he asked for a favor, and the favor was being asked of Atwood through Harriman by Johnson that he never publish anything that Bill Pepper wrote. And Atwood looked at me and said, look, you're not even 30 years old, the President of the United States is saying he doesn't want us to publish. What do you think of that? And I said, I'm more interested in what you said to him. And he smiled and said, I told him that we were going to meet you next week, and if we liked what we heard and saw, we were going to publish, and, by the way, give the president my best regards. Now, Bill Atwood was a very unusual guy in corporate media that was slowly closing. He had a subsequent interview with Jim Garrison on the John Kennedy assassination, called Bobby at 1 o'clock in the morning after that interview the following week. And he said, Bobby, I'm just shaken by the information that the district attorney has given me in terms of the involvement of the CIA in the assassination of your brother. And Bobby said to him, Bill, we know about it, but I have to get the White House in order to do anything about it. That was at 1 a.m. At 4 a.m., Bill Atwood had a heart attack, and he left Look magazine. The associate editor who had brought me in, Chandler Broussard, was fired. New editor came in, and of course, nothing was ever published. So the first book, Orders to Kill, in 1995, was never reviewed. The second book in 2003, An Act of State, took place after a trial. We did a civil trial. I represented the King family. Because the King family and I knew that Martin was assassinated officially, and not by James Earl Ray, the family asked me to represent them, and I suggested we do the civil case against someone we knew who was involved in the killing, a fellow named Lloyd Jowers. We tried that case over 30 days, 70 witnesses, and laid out, at that point in time, we laid out the information that the evidence had given us as to how and why Martin King was killed. So the family eventually came to closure with this matter following the 2003 book. Between 2003 and now, 2016, right. an amazing amount of new evidence and information has come forward, and it will be contained in the book.
Here's what I'd like you to do. We're up to the end of this program, but I have a two-hour special on Martin Luther King, where I'm playing many of his, what I consider his most important, at least to me, they were important, inspiring speeches. We also have Chris Hedges coming on. We have several people coming on who have something to say about Martin Luther King and his life. And so why don't you, if you can, stick around, because I'd like for you to share some your own thoughts, or we can call you back. And so we can go into some of the newest information on King's assassination.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. If we have a time frame, that's all. If you
how about we call you at 2 o'clock?
All okay, right? In 1 hour's time.
About one hour's time from now. All right.
Okay, call me back on this number at 2:00. And how much time do you think you'll need, Gary?
About a half hour.
Okay. All right. Call me back at 2 o'clock, and we'll continue.
Thank you, William.
You're welcome.
William Pepper, one of the deans of American civil liberties. He is a fighter. He's a very educated man. Aside from being a visiting fellow at Cambridge, he also has degrees from Columbia University, a doctorate in education from the University of Massachusetts, a jurisprudence doctorate from Boston College. And he has done more research than any human being I know on the planet on the truth behind Martin Luther King's death. And we're going to learn some new information about it. We'll be back in a moment to hear the next 2 hours, unless you're listening over the internet. But if you're listening to a terrestrial station, you'll hear the next 2 hours. I think you'll find it interesting.